Hello, everyone. Welcome and thank you for joining this conference call with Greg Romont, President and CEO of Centurion Asset Management. As you've undoubtedly heard, my name is Paul Mayer. I'm head of sales, and I will serve as moderator for this call, which should last around 30 minutes. Some of the questions which Greg will be addressing were submitted by you, the advisor community. Given the size of this call, all participants have been placed on listen only. Today, Greg will discuss the prospects for the various subsectors of Canadian real estate in a post-COVID world, as well as how the Centurion Apartment REIT is faring and positioned going forward. We're pleased to report that the Centurion Apartment REIT is weathering the current crisis extremely well. Monthly rent collections, which already, while already high throughout the crisis, have now returned to basically normal. And interest on only two loans in the mortgage book remain in arrears. And year to date, the REIT's return is over 3%, leading to an annualized return since 2009 inception of over 13.6%. Well, thus, without further ado, let's get started. Greg, as always, great to have you once again on an update call.
Thanks, Paul, and thank you to everyone who's attending.
So, given that the main thrust of this call is an evaluation of the different Canadian real estate subsectors, to begin, what are some of the main drivers you look at in a real estate subsector, possibly to later invest in?
Well, to start off, I want to say that the reason I wrote the article in the first place is to address the misunderstandings, in my view, in many conversations, that there is such thing as a homogenous real estate market. You know, we now probably have the best example in history of why that's not true. And historically, the cliche has always been location, location, location. And today, while location still matters and is part of our selection criteria, the sectoral considerations will dominate returns in real estate for years to come. The main drivers for me in selecting investment have always been the economic resiliency of the investment sector that I'm looking at, having low volatility, reasonable returns when adjusted for risk, whether there are major headwinds or tailwinds to the success of your strategy, and then ultimately drill down. So those are all like the top-down type drivers, and then bottom-up is you still want to have a great location. Property selection is important. Pricing matters. And you need to have an asset-specific strategy to be able to add value. So it's not just you can't just go bottom-up. You have to go top-down, and you have to do both of them.
Great. Well, thank you so much for setting the stage. So actually, before we go to student housing, because I know we've gotten a lot of questions regarding student housing, I'd actually like to start with turning to two individual subsectors so we can almost dispense with them. Hotels versus seniors living. Which gives you the most concern?
Well, neither of these sectors are ones that we've ever really been comfortable with or invested in or I like personally. But let's start with hotels and resorts. One of the riskiest real estate sectors, and this industry really has never seen a crisis like today. Many require high occupancy rates just to break even, where today occupancy on many is in the 5 to 10% range if they're open at all. Mortgage financing is next to impossible today in that sector, and it's likely going to be battered for years as the lockdown has not only damaged discretionary spending, but, you know, if we think about where some of these high-density hotels are located, they're unattractive, you know, for business travel as well. If people aren't flying because they're afraid to, whether there's any justification to fly or not fly, that's still going to be a headwind for a while. And I think, you know, a lot of hotels rely on the business travel crowd in urban centers to succeed. And while in-person meetings will pick up and so will business travel, we really need to ask ourselves if our expectations to meet have changed. And I would say that people have become so used to Zoom calls and recognized the huge time savings and money savings that are possible. And as a result, I believe the face-to-face expectation will have changed and likely for the long term. So it's pretty negative for hotels. Moving to seniors, I can't think of a sector that's going to face more problems than this industry, and it's never going to be the same. The vast majority of COVID-19 deaths were in seniors facilities, and these seniors facilities will have significant problems not only attracting residents. I think they're going to be seen as an absolute last resort for those without options. For some people, these kind of facilities weren't just we're seen as not terrible places because you had the services and you also had built-in friendships and activities and all these kind of things. Now I think, for those that have choice, so they'll choose not to send them there. Families that were unable to see or assist their parents or grandparents in the lockdown will not be looking to move them there anytime soon, if ever at all. And it's been somewhat disappointing to say that the problems in the industry are really industry problems. But it's really, there's blame to go all around, because it was also governments that created a lot of these problems. So there's no doubt in my mind that this sector is going to be the most hammered. There'll be more regulations. There will be extra operating costs. Governments have already talked about that they're going to provide extra money for some of these things. But I'm not certain that will actually help in terms of regulation or the regulation to cover the regulatory costs. But the reputational damage, there's a number of class action lawsuits against some of these operators, whether you believe that they're liable or not. So there's legal liability costs and a reduced desirability to live there, demand from residents. And I think from an investor's, there's no way that there's a tailwind here that people are going to be attracted to. And, when we think about normal real estate or any kind of market turndowns, you get buyers who come out on an opportunistic basis. I think in a number of sectors in the post-COVID world, that those opportunistic buyers are going to say, well, there is actually no, buying the dip is not necessarily the smart move here, because there's no tailwinds to build a true recovery. So pretty pessimistic on that.
Well, that's fantastic. Thanks so much for that insight. So as I alluded to, a fair number of submitted questions revolved around student housing. So, Greg, could you please provide an update as to how that part of the portfolio is faring?
Sure. First off, I'm grateful that the investment community has come to understand and embrace the student residence component of the portfolio. Centurion's emergence as one of Canada's largest non-governmental owner-operators of student residence was a deliberate move into a sector where I saw opportunity and where operational skill still provides great barriers to entry. It really is a reflection that real estate is not a static game, and you have to position your portfolios to where opportunities arise and take an active role in ensuring their success. All that said, I'd like to remind everyone that the student residence component of the REIT is today only about 9% of assets and dropping, because it's been very difficult for us to buy any new student residences in a while. Our student residences are primarily catered to second year and up students. They're the only residence where we have first years in residence is actually our tenant is a university, so they're the ones taking the occupancy risk. We don't have any risk on that. So we anticipate that the vast majority are going to show up for school, even if part or all of their classes remain online. Many can't work from home or don't want to. And, quite frankly, COVID resulted in the largest test of online learning in history, and it was a dramatic failure. Students hated it. Something in the order of 50% of students don't have an adequate place in their homes to study remotely, and something on the order of 25% of students don't have fast or reliable enough internet to study from home, which raises significant access and inequality issues. And, you know, given certainly inequality has been on the radar for a long time. I think in the last few weeks, that has become rapidly or very important to or really has become highlighted. So I think there's going to be a lot of hesitation to disenfranchise such a large portion of students by not permitting online or not permitting actual attendance at class. So, you know, while classes may be disrupted in the short term, and occupancy may suffer in the short term, but the opposite might also be true. The on-campus residences are usually based on having two students per room and social distancing to the extent that it continues to be in place at all or not, may mean that the universities have to may have dramatic shortages of residence beds or no beds at all, because a number of residences have even those with singular rooms, have chosen not to open because they have common bathrooms, forcing students into the off-campus community. International student demand may decline in the short term due either to travel restrictions or some will refuse to pay full prices for a reduced experience. Those disruptions will likely prove temporary, particularly given that this young demographic has very limited risk to COVID-19. We've often heard it said that someone of that age group has a greater chance of being struck by lightning than they do of having serious consequences from COVID. So I do expect in the short term, vacancies could be, but may not necessarily be higher than normal until campuses open more fully and international students that aren't already here come back. Early data released by the universities just in the last few weeks suggest that acceptance rates are up from last year as fewer students are taking a gap year. There were early fears that students would take a gap year rather than be forced to do it online just because how poor the experience online schooling is. However, it seems that since working and travel, which were normally be what a student would do during a gap year, those things aren't feasible today. As such, getting out of the house, away from your parents, and towards adulthood seems to be the choice that students are making. Centurion certainly was an early buyer in this space, but we've not bought anything more in years, really, as some other firms were willing to pay far more than we considered to be the appropriate price for assets. While we anticipate there will be, in the next couple of months, we think there could be some opportunities for us to pick up some of these properties from overly leveraged, poorly capitalized, or inexperienced operators in the month ahead. You know, we've even in good times, we've seen good buildings be poorly operated and people lose their properties or have to sell them because they just can't operate them properly. It is such an intense operating business, and you don't have the operating infrastructure. It's just not something that you can just say, oh, let's buy a student building and off you go. I believe groups without deep equity capital and liquidity could see mortgage availability challenges. Centurion recently completed two student property refinancings at rates at or below what would have been available pre-COVID. So it hasn't affected us. And that's because we've got a very large balance sheet. We're experienced operators and been doing this for a long time. So if banks are going to put money towards student housing operators, they're going to go to the best capitalized and the most experienced groups. And fortunately, we fall into that. I think that there might be some room for cap rates to go up, enough for the returns to be attractive for us to begin buying again. And we really are eagerly looking for opportunities because we still very much like this space. and see any disruption as an opportunity to build the portfolio, but only when the returns make sense to us.
Well, thanks, Greg, for that comprehensive analysis of student housing today. Turning to a couple other sectors, I know that you have been bemused, to say the least, of some of the extreme measures offices and retailers have taken to ensure social distancing amidst the pandemic, and in fact are saddened by the terrible costs they have paid. But you say that the challenged future of these two real estate sub-asset classes lies beyond COVID. Care to explain?
Yeah, sure. For office buildings, we've just had the largest experiment in work from home ever conducted. And for the most part, unlike online learning, it worked. So more and more companies are exploring permanent or flexible work from home policies for part or all of their staff, which I believe will permanently reduce the demand for office space. While some have tried to make the argument that the counterbalance may be that companies will opt for more space to densify their offices, thereby reducing the trend towards employee densification that has been playing out for years, I really find that to be a spurious argument. While I agree that we still need office space for its social and collaborative benefits, I believe that office space demand is going to take a permanent hit. The climb out of this recession will be a very long one for offices. Yes, social distancing will someday end, either with herd immunity or a vaccine, but the damage is going to be done. And we will have become so used to working remotely, and companies will now see that it works and will be happy to embrace the cost savings. I mean, we had never permitted work from home in our company until this event, because we were afraid of the loss of productivity and collaboration. We surveyed our own workforce about returning and about other aspects of the pandemic, including how well they work from home and whether they want to or continue to make use of a permanent flexible work program. So I think it's worthwhile to examine these results. And I mean, I don't think that they were from our workforce, but they seem to be resonating with other surveys that other employers, particularly in our space, have been finding from their own teams. So 99% of our staff thought that they had everything they needed to perform the roles working from home. So that's just absolutely unbelievable to me when I heard that. Almost 98% reported they were as productive or more productive than they were before. 62% said they were as productive, and 35% said they were even more productive. 96% said they had the technology to remain connected to their team. 84% preferred to continue to work from home if it was an option. 84%, I'm going nuts at home. But 84% of people were saying that, you know, they'd like to continue. 99% found it valuable to have a permanent post-COVID work from home program. And 73% would work from home an average of 50% of the time. So if they had the choice in a post-COVID world, this is even, you know, assuming there was a vaccine. So I think the office sector will face the loss of tenants that go bust, slower than normal recovery out of an economy which impacts demand or reduces demand, because who wants to wait 2 hours a day for elevators while those rules last? And the whole nature of what we thought work could be, and how office space we need, how much office space we need as a result. The headwinds are long-term, and my conclusion is that vacancies will go up, rents will go down, capitalization rates up, and values are going to drop. Although, you know, again, this is going to be very site-specific, but then these are general trends. For retail, it's been in decline with the assault of online platforms like Amazon stealing business. Many retail stores were going bankrupt even pre-COVID. So what's really happened is that trend is accelerated during COVID, and even with full reopening, the prospects for retail are exceptionally poor. Online shopping has bled sales away from traditional retailers for years, but COVID-19 has accelerated that trend because the lockdown has lasted as long as it has, and many more people than before will have shifted such a portion of their buying online, and we'll now see that as easier, more convenient than going to the store. The best hope for retail properties, in my view, is conversions to residential via intensification, which has already been a trend for years. Almost every major retail landlord in the last few years has been trying to add apartments or condominiums to their sites to diversify their income streams or de-risk themselves. At most retail plaza, landlords are collecting much less than half the rents. I know that enclosed retail is getting less than 35% of rents, which is just catastrophic. And the numbers month on month are getting worse, not better. I think the only conclusion from that is more of these, the retailers are just giving up or running out of funds, whereas they might have floated it for a month, as we've gone now from April, May, June without reopenings or with reduced openings. They just haven't got the financial capability to survive. So this is a situation that even with reopenings, if like in areas like Toronto, where we're still in phase one, if you can believe it, even a reopening may make the situation worse. If you have to have more staff to cover less volume, I just don't know how you make it work. You know, even looking at restaurants, if you need 70% occupancy just to break even to survive, opening at 25 to 50% is due to social distancing bylaws or customer fears means you're probably worse off open than you are closed. Yes, governments have designed programs to lend companies to bridge them until better times, but I think many of these people will find it unattractive to stack on debt month after month with no assurance of survival. So let's look at our illustrious mayor in Toronto, Tory. He announced on the 29th of May that major banks and firms were asked not to return to downtown towers until at least September. And I've been told from a number of sources that these bank employees are being whisper advised that there's no return until at least January. But that what they're doing to avoid the panic of some of these retail shops and the businesses is the message that it's September and when we know it's not, which I think is just horribly unethical. But anyway, and you think about it, for the 1,200 shops and services that are in the 30-kilometer path, Toronto's underground complex, this will mean near certain death for those businesses with, you know, few of the regular 200,000 commuters that regularly used it before for almost a period of 10 months. I mean, who can survive that? The many other businesses rely on the downtown businesses and commuter crowd face a similar fate. So I've heard numerous retail landlords talk about retail being more than shopping, that it's an experience. But, you know, and then as such, once the health crisis is over with a vaccine or a cure, retail returns to normal, but I'm just not so optimistic. Retail was on the decline before, and this just reinforces and accelerates a trend of decline that was already in place. So I really expect an acceleration of the trend of retail or residential intensification and conversion. We've already seen a number of announcements from large or major retail property owners that they're looking to scale back their portfolios of retail. And this is exactly what I addressed in my report. It's part of what I see as a shift of capital from some of these sectors in decline into the ones that I think are have tailwinds. So retail, I expect cap rates to go up, rents to go down, and the values to go down. And you know, part of it is going to be from a lack of investor interest. There'll be more sellers than buyers for a while.
Wow. Well, thanks, Greg, for that overview. Yeah, very sobering, no question about it. Before we touch upon multifamily, is there another subsector which you are interested or have been interested in exploring?
Yeah, I mean, we've been interested in it a while, but coming out of the health crisis, I do believe that medical offices are going to be the exception to the headwinds in the office space. The need for doctors has not gone away. If anything, our doctors, many of whom have had to work from home as discretionary procedures were delayed. And I use the word discretionary in quotes because I think a lot of those discretionary operations for people who need heart surgery, cancer surgery, were not discretionary at all, and they ended up dying. Well, you know, so we're going to see the fastest return to being fully busy of any real sector. And they will have long lines to catch up. So there's also some distinct locational and clustering benefits of being in a dedicated medical office that makes it more resilient than standard offices. It's possible that some doctors don't need to be close to a hospital, can be tempted into cheaper conventional offices, and I've heard that said. But I don't think this is too likely, as most doctors' office space is small, averaging about 1,000 square feet. So the savings would likely be marginal anyway, and they tend to be resistant to moving away from where their current patient roster visits them. Patients like doctors also prefer dedicated facilities where they can see their specialist referrals or have their tests done. Virtual care, i.e. remote work, is possible, but not for everything. So even though some doctors will come into their offices less, they will still need offices to actually meet with patients that need to be seen. This will really improve the patient experience long term. I think it's a great, it's actually work from home for doctors, or virtual care is a great innovation. And instead of driving to and from the doctor's office and then waiting forever for your turn, you're now able to conduct your online for many things. You know, like I think about when I needed to go and get a prescription renewal, I used to have to drive 45 minutes to my doctor's office, wait the hour for my turn, and then drive 45 minutes back. And it was 2.5 hours of kill time. Now you can stay in your office and you get a phone call that shows up in a half hour window, and I didn't have to leave. I think that's tremendous improvement in the experience, unless you needed to do something in the office. So I expect rents there to remain intact, capitalization rates to remain unchanged, or even potentially decline as investors put increasing focus on economically resilient property types.
Oh, very interesting. I look forward to us exploring that medical office space even more. So now taking us to multifamily. Now, I know that you outlined a very strong case for investing in the multifamily space, both now and in the future, on our previous call a few months ago, which I just would like to remind everybody can still be heard in a replay mode on our website. Greg, would you care to add with any new observations? And maybe perhaps you could begin with a comment on the prospects for the appraisals of the underlying buildings.
Sure. I don't really see much impact on valuations. While rent increases that were in the pipeline have been deferred for humanitarian reasons, we really didn't think it was the right thing to do to be increasing rents on people in lockdown or might be suffering work interruptions. And, you know, we just thought that the messaging of that was certainly also terrible. So we moved early to suspend any kind of rent increases. They will resume in the not too distant future as the economy starts to reopen. Frankly, the performance of apartments, the high availability of debt capital at reasonable cost will keep valuations intact. I mean, as I've said, you know, we can get today 10-year money. We took in the last month, we've done two loans. We've done one at just this week. We got some 10-year money at 1.81 last month, with some in the mid 160s. And we have a couple of others that are getting done, and we're expecting financing like closing between 1.6, 1.8 as the average. So to put that into perspective, that's, call it 75 basis points less than it cost 6 months ago. So, you know, I feel pretty good about that. You know, if anything, I believe that there, that as institutions that are under allocated to apartments start to deploy, it's going to be a huge tailwind for the sector. I mean, we've talked about how retail and office and seniors, those are huge sectors. And I believe there's going to be a lot of money that's going to get shifted out, and it's going to be looking for a home that still real estate is considered, you know, a great diversifier for these portfolios and highly sought after. But largely speaking, institutional money is under allocated to apartments in part because it's so difficult to allocate capital to the space. I mean, you know, like the average building is trading between $10 and $30 million, and you know, you go and buy Scotia Plaza and you spent a few billion dollars. Mm-hmm. So it's just for a large fund, it's much easier to make an allocation to something like that than to go together and put do onesies and twosies, right? Mm-hmm. So,
but yeah, but you. Sorry, what I was saying is you have a great take on, you know, the importance of debt and equity capital, because yes, not everybody can actually is positioned to take advantage of it. Like, not everybody's getting, you know, the 1.6s in terms of 10-year money. So care to comment on that?
Yeah, no, I think capital availability, both debt and equity, is the lifeblood of real estate because it is capital intensive. Real estate's a leverage strategy, so reasonably priced mortgage debt is key to achieving good long-term returns. Mortgage availability is a risk factor in the real estate business because leverage introduces risk by accentuating losses in a downturn. And if your mortgage matures at a time when debt is expensive or unavailable, it could force a property owner into financial distress. I mean, you go back and think about if you had a retail plaza or you have a hotel and your mortgage has matured or is maturing, how do you get a new mortgage? I mean, you might be faced with you're just in default and you're going to have to do something about it, like sell the property, or you've got a really, really strong balance sheet and your bank is going to give you some time. But otherwise, if you're not well capitalized, I think you got some real problems. You know, apartments along with seniors facilities and sometimes student housing have the unique benefit of having access to CMHC insured mortgage financing. And this insurance means that a mortgage lender does not have risk if a mortgage defaults, making these really attractive investment for banks, insurance companies, pension funds, even during a financial crisis. An investor with a CMHC insured mortgage benefits by getting a lower cost mortgage than a conventional mortgage, and also because these are the most sought after mortgages, you know, as access to a mortgage or a renewal upon maturity is nearly guaranteed. So this is certainly one of the strengths for, you know, that CMHC insurance helps keep the supply and quality of the housing stock in place, most of which was built 50 to 60 years ago, by keeping lenders interested to provide capital to housing providers. And because it's a low risk business, it helps keep those housing providers financially stable and to continue to meet their maintenance and capital reinvestment requirements. And this insurance also lowers the risk of owning apartments and other insurable classes. So it encourages investment in housing, whether new or the existing stock. Other real estate sectors that don't have the benefit of this insurance can see access to debt and equity capital becomes constrained, particularly during a crisis like COVID or the great financial crisis. Mortgage availability can become restricted, lowered, leverage lowered, interest rates increased, or be altogether unavailable. The same can happen with equity capital. While mortgage markets continue to function for apartments, like I've mentioned, other sectors saw really severe disruptions to capital availability. This increased cost of debt, lower leverage, reduced availability increases the cost of equity for those sectors, squeezing returns, pressuring up cap rates, reducing values, reducing transaction volume and liquidity, which itself becomes almost a bit of a self-feeding cycle of negativity and acts as another headwind. So it's my contention that not only will apartments continue to be the best performing subsector in months and years ahead, but this superior performance during a crisis will cause a great rotation towards apartments by institutional investors who are largely underweight the sector. It was my view pre-COVID that the next decade would be see the most investment in new apartments in two generations to meet the nation's growing housing needs. And I'd refer people to my April 27th paper for the case that I made there. I believe the case for apartments as an asset class has not only strengthened, but become more obvious to everyone. I've been pounding about apartments and their safety for a long time, and I think it wasn't obvious to everybody, but it is now. For the reasons outlined in this call, some of the capital may have gone into the beaten down sectors like retail and corporate. Betting on a recovery likely won't be there or in the same quantity because the headwinds are from paradigm shifts, not just the usual and temporary recessionary factors. This is likely to make the headwinds to recovery of these sectors much longer than normal and attract more capital than would otherwise be the case to sectors that show the most promise for returns and stability. I'd just like to conclude by saying that, I remain just as bullish on the prospects for our REIT today as I did pre-COVID. I hope I outlined in this call, I think Canadian multifamily has, if anything, distinguished itself even more during the crisis. And I expect to continue to do so in the future. I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for us on the horizon. So, I look forward to and appreciate the support and capital from our investors and advisors that have allowed us to do that.
Greg, well, we almost hit our 30-minute mark, just a little bit over. Greg, thank you so much. Not only did you provide a timely update on the REIT, but also within the context of assessing the strong positives of the multifamily space within the broader Canadian real estate sector. Greg, once again, thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thank you, everyone, for joining.
Oh, Greg, thank you again. And also many thanks to everyone who's on the call today. Centurion, we're all very grateful for the continued support you, our cherished investment advisory community, provides us. I'd like to remind everyone that the Centurion Apartment REIT is open for investment at least until September 1st, so we're open at least throughout the summer. And this call will be available on replay at centurion.ca in a few days. Should you have any follow-up questions at all, please do not hesitate to contact your wholesaling team. Once again, thank you so much for being on the call and have a great day.